Hey, sex fans! Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, August 21st, 2013, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge. And I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick.
Oh, boy. You really are having a field day, aren't you?
You can say that again, because you know why? Kate is back. That's Dr. Catherine Frank, cultural anthropologist, sex researcher, and noted author to you guys, don't you know? And this is the Sex Wisdom Show. So we got such an amazing response after last week's episode that I could hardly contain myself for her return today. And I'll just bet she's bringing us more of her signature candor and insight. But wait, you didn't miss part one of this show, did you? Well, not to worry if you did, because you can find it and all of my podcasts in the podcast archive on my site, drdicksexadvice.com. All you got to do is use the search function in the header, type in podcast number 386, and voila! But don't forget to use the pound sign when you do your search.
I'm numbed enough so that I can take you when we're alone. I don't listen anymore. But if I do listen, I sift everything so I don't really hear you, which is about the only way to manage it.
And yet you're in the audience every week. I don't get it. So Catherine invites you to visit her on her site, cleverly named katefrank.com. And through her site, you'll be able to buy all of her books. However, for your convenience, there will be links to her books in today's podcast posting on drdicksexadvice.com. Today's program is once again brought to you by Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. You know, even though I get tons of email from folks looking for my advice, I can only respond to a limited number of inquiries at any given time. But that doesn't mean I don't care about everyone who writes in. I do. That's why I've set up the How-To Video Library. You'll find a link to this great resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the Video Library tab in the header.
That's a desperately sick lie.
No, it's not. The Video Library is the go-to place for all of you who have sexual performance questions. You'll be able to watch all kinds of deliciously entertaining, delightfully enriching, and so informative videos right from the comfort of your own home. And remember, a portion of the money you spend at Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library, educating, enriching, and entertaining yourself, comes back to us as support for these marvelous shows. So knock yourself out. Okay, on with the show. Kate Frank, thanks again for joining us here at drdicksexadvice.com for this Sex Wisdom podcast. I am so delighted that you're back. We had such great feedback about last week. You are a treasure so knowledgeable and conversant about the topics that we've been discussing so far. Most of last week was a little bit background on you, and we began talking about your book, Plays Well in Groups, A Journey Through the World of Group Sex. So I'd like to pick up where we left off. We were talking about some people's misperceptions about group sex, and that it's a free-for-all, and that is never the case, not even in violent group sex like group rape. So the traditional power dynamic between men and women is, generally speaking, turned on its head when we consider group sex, particularly in the context of swinging. Would you not agree with that?
You know, I don't necessarily think so.
Okay.
Structural power differences in any society don't disappear just because people decide to act in ways that are sort of lying outside of the social norms.
Right.
So certainly in a swinger context, in a U.S. context, some norms of heterosexual behavior are challenged, right?
Right.
So men are expected to allow their spouses to have outside sexual encounters instead of just themselves, right, secretly or women who would be considered slutty in another setting are treated as more valuable.
Right.
But we can't avoid all those things that structure how we get to a certain space and how we interact inside. And I actually interviewed a woman at one point who was Brazilian, who, you know, she said, all men cheat, and this is my way to keep an eye on my husband.
Oh, interesting.
And so, you know, her experiences of the world and why she was, you know, in the same setting, they're not completely comparable or the same, right?
Right.
She came in with a different understanding of marriage, a different idea about male power, and, you know, a different place where she lived, right? Where she didn't want to lose her husband. And
right.
I think that there are women who do that. I'm not saying that that's the only place where women might make that decision.
Right.
But I'm just saying, like, the meanings of marriage and monogamy and male and female sexuality, all those things come into play with how people even understand what they're doing when they get into a group sex situation, right?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that I asked that question was that I'm aware of the fact that at, like, some swinging clubs, it's female-oriented is probably the best way to put it, where a single man cannot go into the play space without being accompanied by a woman, and it looks like, and maybe it's just a question of an appearance, but it looks like that women are more in charge than traditionally speaking in sex roles.
Right. Right, so you do get some very interesting means of negotiation,
mm-hmm.
because women are sort of, there's a gender scarcity going on in heterosexual sex text,
uh-huh.
right? So, and I actually did a little bit of this in the book where I was looking at the different rules of, you know, group sex spaces.
Right.
So where I was saying that rules always hold, but how they play out are different.
Right.
So there were some researchers who studied in a gay bathhouse, for example, and they said that, you know, a way to initiate contact was to, you know, stare at the man or group of men you wanted to join and start masturbating, right?
Right.
Now, I couldn't test that for myself because I've asked, but at any rate, you know, that seems to have, no one who I asked about it responded negatively to that, but if you tried that in a heterosexual sex club, you're going to be seen as creepy,
right?
I mean, that's not how you initiate contact, and staring and masturbating is going to be seen as too invasive
right.
for women and men
right.
in those settings,
right?
right? So certainly there are ways that with women in the space that the negotiation happens differently. But I guess I wouldn't say that, you know, the power dynamic. I know some people like to say that the power dynamic is completely changed. I do think that, you know, women exercise some interesting, women have some interesting privileges in those spaces, but I just don't think that everything that we bring with us on our way there is left behind, right? So some spaces are, for example, closed to everyone but those who meet a certain level of standard beauty, right?
That's so true.
And that's like that in gay male
right.
worlds and straight worlds, right? So, I mean, some of the gay male circuit parties and club events are very, very homogenous in terms of body type, body
right.
presentation.
Right.
And you can see the same everywhere, you know, in all of these different kind of social sex spaces.
And as you were saying, a lot of the sexual, traditional sexual taboos apply even in the context of, like, heterosexual sexual fringe, like swinging, where male-on-male sexual behavior is at least uncomfortable, if not prohibited, but female-on-female sexual behavior is encouraged and, you know,
right.
made to look like this is the norm.
Well, and I think in every setting you get sort of this fractal sort of positioning of, you know, mainstream and fringe, right? And then within the fringe, there's a mainstream fringe and a fringy fringe. And again,
so
you do have parties or events in the U.S., for example, where, you know, there's bisexual men and there's, you know, and they're coupled, you know, like lifestyle couples, but it's fringy, right? That's right. The edgier stuff. Right. It's not the mainstream. And the same with, say, BDSM. You know, you have a lot of parties where there's no sex in the place, right?
Absolutely.
Then you have some where those things are getting mixed in together, and those are the fringier ones or the edgier ones.
Right.
So they happen, but there's a lot of policing that goes on.
Right.
Even in a supposedly transgressive space, there's a lot of policing.
Right. Speaking of sexual taboos, you have an entire chapter in your book called Disgust, Shame, and Guilt, The Primordial Soup of Desire. Disgust, shame, and guilt are the tools the dominant culture uses to keep order in society. But the tighter that those screws are turned, the more that they stimulate desire. At least that's how I kind of look at things. Is that your perception as well?
Well, let me take those in two different parts.
Cool.
I certainly would agree that the there can be a stimulation of desire from prohibitions, right?
Right.
But, you know, I would take after Freud and say that disgust, shame, and guilt are social emotions. So they can be used by people in power to accomplish particular ends. So ideologies that some people's bodies are more disgusting or polluting than other people's bodies, those play a role in maintaining social hierarchies, right? So these emotionally laden ideologies can have a really powerful hold on us and affect us both consciously and unconsciously. But even a perfect culture, well, you know, or even a more egalitarian culture where there wasn't necessarily a dominant group, you know, that there will still be disgust, shame, and guilt because we're social creatures and our bodies and our behaviors are meaningful to ourselves and others, and especially at these boundaries like I was talking about last week. So we compare ourselves to others and we develop a sense of self that requires that we distinguish between the inside and outside of our bodies, what is us and what is someone else. And disgust, shame, and guilt help us do that.
Mm-hmm.
People who don't recognize those boundaries are often seen as either children, babies, really, because children are learning them, or insane, right, or incapacitated in some way.
Right.
So,
and there's a real price to pay for violating cultural norms until they change.
right. And so that gets to the idea of stimulating desire, right? Because transgressors can be created by prohibitions, right? But at the same time, they need those prohibitions. And if they want to be doing something that feels dangerous, that feels rebellious, exciting, right? They need the taboo.
Right.
They're tied to it, right?
Right.
So once you overcome, once you've broken all your taboos, what's left, right?
Right. I've heard lots and lots of gay men, and I think I include myself amongst them, talking about, you know, as gay society or gay life becomes more and more mainstream, a lot of the edginess and what we imagined was special about us disappears, and that leaves us, you know, in a quandary about who we are. It seems to me.
Very true. And you see it in BDSM as well.
Right, exactly.
Right, where the proliferation of rules, right, the community, they need rules. They want to, and I'm generalizing, so again, for the purpose of conversation, but, you know, a community that wants to sort of mediate their relationship with the mental health industry, right, and say, just because this is what we like in our private life doesn't mean we are in need of some kind of psychological intervention,
but
there's a move to normalize it, right? There's also a move to standardize things so that people don't, so that risks are managed. But at the same time, then you also you create new outlaws, right?
Exactly.
And people
because
who
somebody, you know, who rebels against that and say, well, you know, I'm just going to take my sexual behavior and become more extreme because, you know, I want to remain this edgy personality, and that's what gives my life meaning.
Right. And so, you know, over the years, you've had people or groups who've taken this idea of transgression and given it additional meanings about either spiritual transcendence
or political
change, right? So the Marquis de Sade, Crowley, the 1970s hippies, lots of philosophers and artists and visionaries believed that sexual transgression could possibly create a different and or better society, right?
Yeah.
That it might actually lead to the complete breakdown of the culture as it is now, and, you know, the recreation of something. Unfortunately, you know, transgression becomes a dead end as a political strategy and personal strategy, as we're talking about, right? Uh-huh. So you can become desensitized. You can reach to the edge, the very last edge, right? Not the cultural edge, but the actual physical edge of death. Yes. Or, right? You can only push your boundaries of your body so far. So, you know, transgression becomes a little bit of a disillusion, or it can lead to experiences of, you know, feeling disillusioned with one's path. You do see this also in some of the, you know, believers in sexual transgression as a way to overthrow the dominant culture or overcome capitalism or break down, you know, religious morality, whatever they want it to do. And so I think, you know, in the end, we really shouldn't put out so many of our hopes into sexuality or sex. And also, we shouldn't put as many of our fears, right? We really surround it with so many things. It's not necessarily going to change the world. It's not necessarily going to ruin the world.
Exactly. So I'd like to move on in the little time that we have left to your other book, which is equally fascinating, G-Strings and Sympathy, Strip Club Regulars and Male Desires, which was published in 2002. I read somewhere that, in fact, you said this last week, that you worked as a stripper to get your data for your dissertation, and I'm guessing that this book is based on your thesis?
It was, yes. So I worked specifically in clubs for 15 months. I had designed a study that required me to work in clubs for 15 months, and I chose five different clubs that were one from the nicest to the supposedly diviest in the city as a comparison.
So let's talk about sex work in general. Regardless of religion, nationality, gender, everyone seems to have an opinion about sex workers, and many are quick to judge the oldest profession and will happily categorize all those who belong to it into some sort of stereotypical misconception or worse. And while it's easy for any of us to pass judgment unless we are in the same occupation, it's impossible to really know why sex workers do what they do. And I think that's why your research is so valuable.
Well, I think that question is... I came from a position, I think, that I was interested in that question. Like, why do so many of us want to understand why sex workers do what they do, right? Like,
right.
Think about how that question itself is so loaded, because do we worry as much about why, you know, policemen want to do what they do? Well, maybe we worry, but, you know, do we ask that question as much of people who are working in less transgressive sort of occupations, right? So people who break the rules around sexuality, as we've been talking about, can trigger these experiences of disgust or shame or guilt, and they are sometimes viewed as psychologically damaged, right? So, you know...
Or at least a curiosity, even if there's no moral judgment involved. It's curious, like, how is it that you are doing what you're doing and everyone around you says that that's not good or prohibited or against the law, and yet you do it? I mean, I think that's fascinating. I'm curious about why people are transgressive.
And what's funny is I think sometimes the same process happens that we were just talking about with the political revolutionaries, right? I mean, there are some people who enter the sex industry because they want to, they are drawn to the transgressiveness of it, right? On the other hand, once you're there, it becomes about making money. Right? You do the same thing every day. It's not even like it's, I mean, would you keep doing it every day just for the experience? No, you keep doing it because, you know, and in the case of stripping, and I don't want to generalize between stripping and prostitution and all of that right now, but we can just stick to stripping, although some of the things still hold. But, you know, maybe the first night it's really intriguing, but, you know, it's the money that makes it labor, right? And it's all these other things that come into play that make it start to feel like labor too, right? Not necessarily rebellion. At any given time, you can have, you know, encounters or moments that feel amazing or empowering. You can have ones that feel exploitative, but the reality of it all is really a mix of all these different things. And it's the labor perspective that sort of comes out to be dominant for a lot of people in the end.
And I think that's why I'm thinking that that's one of the reasons why the vocabulary has changed from things like prostitution to sex work, because mm-hmm. it's work. And I think the emphasis is on the work part as opposed to the sex part. You know, I've interviewed lots and lots of sex workers on this show, and I know even more. And mm-hmm. most of them say, you know, a good portion of their work is not about sex at all. But it's still work.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's a lot of emotional labor and presentation and listening and right. all of those things, right?
Right. Are you aware of any place in the world that commercing with one's body or one's sexuality is not taboo?
Well, you know, that's hard to answer because I would say that, you know, sex is used as a form of barter or as
yes.
a way to make alliances everywhere. And
absolutely.
True, right? So even if, say, prostitution is illegal, you know, people are bartering for rings and shoes and dates. And
yes,
all
it's
the time.
True.
So I don't even really understand personally. It's not my area, but I don't even understand how prostitution laws are sustainable,
right.
given the amount of trading that goes on.
Right.
For sex all the time, right?
Yeah. Like you give me sex and I'll marry you, and you give me sex and I'll tell you I love you, you give me sex and I'll help raise our offspring. All of that stuff is operative every single day.
Right. But if you try to trade for money, you know, then that's the,
right.
the that's problematic. I mean, actually there are even more complex laws where you aren't allowed to trade for anything of material value. Again, that's not my area, but and I don't think that they are, you know, necessarily policing whether or not people are getting presents or things like that, but it's in there in some places. So at any rate, I think that sex everywhere that I've, you know, read about or, you know, where I've talked to people in the course of researching this over so many years, I really haven't been convinced that there's a place where sex isn't used that way.
Right.
At some level.
There's seems to be a double standard also between men who are sex workers and women who are sex workers, even in stripping. Do you know why that is? I mean, other than the real obvious stuff?
Like the, you mean in terms of the workers?
Yeah, and, you know, women's roles in society and whatnot, and who can make money, and, you know, what privileges males have over females. And
Right. You know, I mean, I think that there's, certainly in terms of, like, the stigma that attaches itself to the customers and the dancers, I think is very different, because I would say even if you're talking about male sex workers versus female sex workers, both of them would be stigmatized more than their clients. So,
very much,
you know, there's
so.
The idea that the customers are sort of just passing through these spaces. They're sort of coming, right?
And then these terrible things happen. That lady took her clothes off.
Right. Right. And then they can go back to, you know, having a different life.
Yes.
Their other life, right?
Yes.
But the sex worker is more permanently marked.
Yes. And yet, all the sex workers I know, I mean, have these remarkable lives. Besides
yeah.
the ones that they're, you know, besides their professional lives, and it's so odd to me. I mean, you know, I mean, I've known people, you know, using sex work as a means to pay, you know, their way through college and graduate school and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, like interning at, you know, Google or Microsoft. I mean,
right.
Come on, you know, it's just, well, anyhow.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that certainly things have changed somewhat since when I first started dancing. It was a while ago now, and it was certainly more, well, for one, couldn't even buy our shoes at a regular mall, right? You had to drive down to, like, some seedy area of town to buy stripper shoes that were clear heels or were, you know, tall enough.
Right.
And now girls walk around in those shoes all the time. I go out to a club now dressed way more stripperish than when I was a stripper. Changed a bit.
It really is. It's amazing kind of thing. And then I think about, you know, how the popular culture almost lionizes male stripping, like the movie, was it Magic Mike? But we still haven't got there all that much, you know, in terms of, you know, women, the same kind of thing for women.
Right. You know, there are changes, but they're always uneven.
Yes.
Like, so I think it's, you know, no matter how accepting the people around you are, there's always going to be some places where just having done something transgressive of that sort is going to make you trash, right? Some of us have enough privileges that we can take that on very publicly, right? So I certainly felt that myself as a researcher, and I'm sure some of the people who've been on your show and are publicly out about their past or present work in the sex industry, you know, there are ways that we can take on that stigma because we're supported in other ways, right?
Inoculate yourself, you know, against that, against the vitriol that, you know, would naturally be yours if you weren't a researcher, for example.
Right, or having other privileges, right?
Yes.
In terms of where you worked, in terms of mobility inside and moving out of the industry, and there's so many things that come into play.
Right. Would you consider yourself an activist for sex worker rights? You said last week that you wrote for Spread Magazine, which is a publication for and by sex workers.
Yeah, I mean, I've written for Spread, and I would certainly do anything I could for sex workers' rights. I mean, I feel that it should be a recognized form of labor.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the protections that, you know, there could be things done to make the industry safer and more humane, right? Because most of the problems seem to stem from the legal climate surrounding the activity and the stigma.
Right.
But my primary job is writing, so I mostly write. I'm not out there in the trenches like some people are, and I'm sort of insulated a bit from the, you know, ongoing battles that sex workers' rights activists have to fight every day. And so I can say things like, well, let's move beyond the empowerment versus exploitation debate. Let's look at it more in a more complex way, right? And that's what we can do in academia. But sometimes if you're sitting there and you're arguing about against people who really take a black and white position on it, right? It's exploitation. It's a privilege to be able to step outside those debates, what I'm saying, right?
It's truly what to say. So finally, two questions. Who inspires you, and who are your sexual heroes, if you have any?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I have sexual heroes, but I have intellectual heroes.
Okay, cool. I've
been inspired by generations of feminists, from Victoria Woodhull to Carol Queen, to Aliyah El Mahdi, the Egyptian woman who was posting the nude photos on Facebook, right? The nude photo revolutionaries who followed. You know, I'm amazed at people's courage to tackle those things in the context in which they do.
Yes.
And then I'm inspired by gonzo journalists and writers like Gay Talese and Hunter Thompson, you know, and people who really had to fight at the edges, you know, of acceptability to do what they wanted to do. And you're one of those as well with your
you
know, work with the Catholic Church. So I'm inspired that also kids who make these videos about cyberbullying and post them on YouTube, you know?
Yes.
So
really,
people who are willing to bring light on issues and things that other people are afraid to tackle.
Great. So, I totally agree. And I certainly would include you on that list. It's been such a joy getting to know you, even though our time has been relatively limited. I thank you so much for spending so much of your precious time with us. It's been enlightening and enriching for us all, myself included. Before you go, would you give us your website address again? Walk us around. Tell us where we can buy your books.
Sure. My website is katefrank.com. And on the site, you can find links to all of my books, and you can find some of my articles in PDF form. You can email me also from the website. And both Plays Well in Groups and G-Strings and Sympathy are available on the main, on the internet sites like Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble.
Thank you again. It's been a joy. Keep up the good work, and perhaps we'll be able to talk again soon. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kate.
Bye.
Be well. Bye.
You too. Bye.
What an outstanding show. Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Everyone here at DrDickSexAdvice.com will be taking a late summer holiday for the next couple of weeks. So podcasts will resume on Wednesday, September 9th, with a swell Q&A show. So tune in then for more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick.
You're so convoluted, that's what you are. You talk like you were writing one of your stupid papers.
Maybe you're referring to my new book, The Gospel of Kink. Well, if you are, tune in a couple of weeks when we talk all about that. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. Listen up, buckaroos. Thanks to this amazing technology, you'll be able to watch your choice of smut from the comfort of your home. With just a little prompting from you, they're going to come gushing out of your computer like nobody's business. Check it out. You'll find a link to this fabulous sex resource right there on the front page of DrDickSexAdvice.com. Look for the tab that reads Video on Demand. There's no membership fee. This is a pay-per-minute sort of deal. So your pay-per-view minutes allow you to watch whatever content you want for whatever length of time you choose. Pretty gall darn sweet, huh? And remember, a portion of the money you spend at Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library, educating, enriching, and entertaining yourself, comes back to us as support for these marvelous shows. So knock yourself out. Until next time, remember, sex is good. And good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.